I'd like now to welcome David France. He's director and co-writer of the documentary How to Survive a Plague, which opens on October 19th at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this is a wonderful documentary, very, very interesting. And I think it's an important one because a lot of people, particularly younger people, may not remember or just don't know how bad things were during the first years of the AIDS epidemic. People were being turned away from hospitals. Tell us what the healthcare system was and was not doing at that time in the early and mid-80s.
Well, the healthcare system was basically broken in America. It was a time of across-the-board deregulation and defunding of public health, and it couldn't have come at a worse time. HIV snuck into the country in 1981, and by the time it was apparent that we had a real massive healthcare crisis on our hands, the hospitals just weren't in a position to be able to cope with it. And you're right, it was bad, and to the point where people were, by 1985, 1986, in the major cities, New York especially, often bringing themselves to the hospital and spending sometimes 5, 6, 7 days in the emergency room trying to get a bed, and often dying right there. So it took a while for the system really to respond in an effective way, and that's what the film How to Survive a Plague is about, how that happened. And that happened principally through the direct intervention of patients who tackled a broken healthcare system and attacked a government which was not only doing very little federally to help fund AIDS research and AIDS care, but was often so hostile to the community of people that were being impacted by the disease, that it almost seemed as though their deaths were being cheered on. And that's where How to Survive a Plague opens up, 1987, which is the dawn of effective AIDS advocacy that took science by the hand and said, we've got to move this thing into crisis mode.
And it was a kind of activism that was so effective that I still think about it today and hold it up as perhaps some of the most effective activism in the history of our country. Tell us about the kinds of things that people actually were doing, the kind of actions on the street and beyond.
Well, what they had to contend with initially was this hostility that I mentioned before. And the very first thing that AIDS activism took on was to establish really the humanity of people with the disease, that it actually needed establishing, that these were human beings who were sick and they deserved compassion at the very least, and health care certainly. And in order to get that message across, they staged some very theatrical, very controversial protests. What they first took on was the medical establishment that wasn't producing any drugs. The epidemic had already killed tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, before the first medication was made available. And that came at a dramatically elevated price. So they did things like storm the New York Stock Exchange to protest the pharmaceutical company that was charging usurious fees for the drugs that were hopefully going to keep people alive longer. Ultimately, what they learned was that the pharmaceutical industry was not developing drugs that were indeed effective, and they began on a campaign of self-education to teach themselves not just the language of immunology and cellular biology, but also the principles of those disciplines, so that they could ultimately help establish a course of action to drag the pharmaceutical researchers onto. Luckily, they found, once they got through the doors of these major pharmaceutical companies, they found researchers who were really wanting to do the right thing and were hoping to fix a system to allow it to be nimble enough to do the kind of research on the kind of drugs in the kind of urgent basis that was going to be necessary to end the plague years.
And one of the things that's so interesting and beautiful in the documentary is that, as you say, they learned the language and the principles of all these disciplines within science and created documents that then people in science and public health and research would look at and say, this is really good.
Right. Right, and against their better wishes.
Right.
You know, their instinct said, look at these, you know, these are untrained people wearing, like, black leather jackets and white T-shirts and pierced ears the kinds of folks that they wouldn't expect that they would be entering into any sort of working coalition with. And that's really the brilliance of this period of activism. It crossed really wide chasms culturally in order to create the kind of partnership that we'd never seen before. And in doing that, and you called this one of the most effective periods of activism, it's really the last great social justice movement in American history and in global history. What, in partnership with the officials at the NIH, FDA, Big Pharma, they revolutionized the way all aspects of science and medicine are practiced. And they gave us, as a legacy of their work, the reality on the ground now, so that anybody with any diagnosis now has a seat at the table through representatives, through advocates, through activists for their disease state, not just at the policy table, but also at the research table. And that interaction between patients and science was an invention of AIDS activists and their advocates, and they did some really amazing things. You know, when they first began, on average, it took about 12 years for a drug to go from a promising compound in a test tube in a laboratory to a drug marketed and available at your drugstore. And because people with AIDS were being given prognoses of about 18 months, they knew they didn't have a dozen years to wait for a promising new compound to come around. So they rather than bypass the system of drug trials and drug approval, they found ways through innovative thinking to narrow that window to get the same reliable results about those drugs in under 2 years. And in the case of the ultimate drug that came and made it possible to survive HIV, the advent of effective anti-AIDS treatment in 1996, that drug, with activist help, was tested and brought to market within 6 months. And now those advances are taken for granted and are reliably part of our healthcare system.
We're talking to David France, director of the documentary How to Survive a Plague. Now, so much of this is archival footage of those days in the 80s and 90s, and that was kind of the early days of video. Where did all this video footage come from?
It's interesting you should point that out, but HIV shows up in 1981. It's when we got our first reports in the papers that something mysterious was happening. And in early 1982 begins the dawn of the home video revolution.
Right.
So those two advents were very close together and became intertwined as AIDS was becoming the pandemic that it is today. By 1987, the community of people affected by the disease knew that their stories weren't being told, and they took it upon themselves to capture those images, not just so that they could show the world that people were not just dying quietly, but in fact fighting valiantly for their lives, but also because they wanted to make sure that the people who died didn't just disappear, that something recorded their existence and their lives really in the brilliance of their struggle to survive. And all of that footage was left behind. I'm an old reporter, and so I had been on the ground covering AIDS by 1987 when activism took this form. And I knew that cameras were an integral part of what activists were using as their among their tools to get their message across. And so as I began this process of looking back, really to see what the legacy of AIDS is, you know, how did it transform America? What did it leave us, both positive and negative? I thought to go back to those cameras and see what I could assemble from, you know, multiple angles over a long period of time. And ultimately, How to Survive a Plague is a story of 9 years of AIDS activism, from the dawn of AIDS treatment activism to this miraculous breakthrough in 1996. And I was able to find that you could tell that story from these cameras that were present then. And what I think that allowed me as a storyteller was to bring the viewer back to those times and watch things unfold in real time. And you get the access to an epic 9-year struggle to survive by looking at this intimate footage gathered then. And you see what it took to bring the entire system around, to turn that ship of research. And then you see the ultimate breakthrough that allows not only the people in the film to survive, but has since then saved over 6 million lives.
Now, you focus on certain activists, and one of them is named Peter Staley, who is still with us. And one of the things that I think is so moving in the film is these young men are asked during that time before this last drug, which has saved so many lives, comes into use. They are asked, "Do you think you'll survive?" And to the last one, they say, "No, I don't think I'm going to survive." And yet they do. Peter Staley, what a force of nature! His little clip on Crossfire is worth going to the whole movie for. I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, I guess certainly was clear if you were on the ground then, and now seems surprising and delightful in retrospect, is the amount of humor that people brought to these really epic battles.
Right.
And not just humor, but kind of a clever ability to approach venerable obstacles, and in some cases enemies, as Pat Buchanan might have been seen as the time, and then bring them along, really to take them by the hand and march them into enlightenment. And we see that in that little exchange on Crossfire, where it's a kind of an activism you don't see so much anymore, that it can be gentle as much as it can be fierce, but always seeks to move the ball forward, and that's what they manage to do. Sometimes with ridicule, sometimes with using shocking imagery or language, but always with this deftness and lightness of hand that allowed them to get their points across and advance their goals.
And it really struck me, I mean, when you are doing activism, which is fighting for your very life, and your life may be very limited, all sorts of creativity comes right out.
It's amazing. And you know what, I guess when I looked back at that footage and rediscovered aspects of this story, I recognized that they weren't just fighting to survive. They were fighting for a kind of a brilliance of life. And that's why I think you see all the generosity that they bring to their encounters with their adversaries, and the sense of humor, which is really sharply drawn in so many instances, and the use of art to convey messages through the media to the American public. You know, several of the people involved in this organizing effort had come from advertising, and others from media. And some from the world of fine art and theater and the like, and they brought all of the tools from those various disciplines all to bear in this struggle in a way that we haven't seen before and haven't seen since. And it makes the story of How to Survive a Plague a really useful blueprint, I think, for other people who are interested in trying to affect change. I know, for example, that it's being the film itself is being shown in underground screenings in Moscow by the pro-democracy movement there.
Interesting.
And we're starting to see aspects of their protests that incorporate the lessons that we learned from ACT UP and the Treatment Action Group and the other AIDS treatment activists on the ground in their use of humor and kind of clever reinterpretation of legal prescriptions and that's the first instance that I know of where those lessons are being replicated kind of point by point.
We're talking about the film How to Survive a Plague. Now, one of the things that I think is one of the greatest artworks ever and was also an example, it kind of, at least to me, changed the way a lot of people thought about art, the way I thought about art, was the AIDS quilt, which was these 3x6 quilt panels, each one of which was an individual artwork, but when taken together, they were a much bigger artwork. And it didn't matter whether you were... I worked in an art space at that time, and we showed, I think, 4 of them in our art space. And then there were other places where they showed untold tens of thousands of them. And it was all still the AIDS quilt, no matter how you displayed it.
Mm-hmm. It was a tremendously moving way to memorialize often nameless dead. The writer Andrew Sullivan has described the quilt as the great horizontal cathedral, and that's what it's like. Really, it has this power of spirituality and remembrance that I've never seen in any other form.
Yeah,
it's now unfortunately way too big to be shown in one place. They brought it to Washington this summer at the International AIDS Conference in July, and it covered the mall, and that was only a small fraction of all the panels. So they brought the other segments to churches and synagogues and houses of worship and schools and museums all around the city in order to be able to say that, you know, for only the third time ever, the entire quilt was in one location.
Are people still making panels for the quilt?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they are. Wow. They're making panels because people still are dying in this country. Almost 2,000 people die every year in this country. 2 million people die every year of AIDS internationally. And it's still a problem. It's still a problem to get health care to people. It is possible to survive this plague, but it's still unlikely. Unless we do something about gathering political will and momentum around the idea that these pills are available. You know, these pills are miracle pills. It's possible if you go on the 3-drug regimen that's now the standard of care, as soon as you're infected, that you will live at least 50 years into the future, that you will have a future. And that's an enormous breakthrough. That's the breakthrough that How to Survive a Plague chronicles. But how do you get those pills now to the so many people who don't have access to health care in this country and internationally?
Exactly.
That's the next challenge. That's the next survival hurdle to mount.
Well, the subtext of the film, really overtly all through the film, was such a sense of love and solidarity and, as you say, community and humor and art. And then this drug was finally discovered and brought forth and people could take it, and you describe in the film a kind of Lazarus effect where people near death were given this drug and they were able to come back. What happened then in terms of community and solidarity and the people who were in this film? Did it begin to disintegrate?
Well, certainly the movement changed. And that makes sense because the movement was so geared toward one thing, survival. And when survival became possible, that was the preeminent goal, and they got it. The movement didn't disappear. It moved internationally. A lot of activism moved to southern Africa, where the challenge of getting pills to people was first broached. And where such good work has been done, really, in southern Africa about getting access to these drugs to people, but for individuals who had been struggling with their own HIV diagnosis or AIDS diagnosis all those years, there was a sudden and really interesting, dislocation that came along with this great good news in 1996. If you had spent 5 years, 8 years, in some cases 15 years, just assuming you were going to die, as much as you argued for breakthroughs that would save you, what we found was that people had really given up the whole idea of a future. So there's a disorientation when a real future arrived, and we talk about that a little bit at the end of the film about, you know, what do you do now?
Right.
After going through this really this technicolor world that's described in How to Survive a Plague, and you get to the end finally, and then you go, well, now what? And these people were still young. I mean, they started in their early 20s, very young people who drove AIDS activism. And when they were given suddenly a renewed lease on life, they were still in their 30s and were really challenged to try to find out what their next missions would be.
Now, what was your role during this whole time?
As I said earlier, I'm a journalist, a print journalist, and I had been reporting on the ground. I'm in the film, way in the background, filling my notepads. I think only my mother could recognize me back there. But and I was on the periphery of AIDS activism as a journalist covering it for the dailies in New York at the time. I wrote the first feature story about ACT UP's formation and really its promise as a political force. Ultimately, I specialized in science in my journalism, and that's one reason I felt it important to bring the viewer into really the scientific challenges that were being approached by these non-scientists who were, inventing a brand new notion of kind of citizen science in their innovative look at all of these scientific challenges. I watched them as they climbed through the doors and windows of their scientific establishments and helped from the inside to bring about this revolution. So I knew the story basically, and I was surprised over the years that nobody had really told it, that no one had gone to celebrate this tremendous impact of this scrappy group of people, mostly sick people given basically death sentences. And that over the years, as you said at the top of our conversation, over the years that history faded really from consciousness, and it seems now that I'm just reintroducing it with How to Survive a Plague, but that we had failed to somehow transmit it down the generational lines.
Exactly.
Until now.
Well, and I mean, it's a walk down memory lane with Ronald Reagan and the first George Bush and Jesse Helms and all those lovely people. How do you think how do you perceive that the political situation has changed, not just in terms of AIDS and HIV, but homophobia in general?
Well, before AIDS activism, when AIDS first struck, it's hard to remember and certainly hard to convince younger people that gay people had absolutely no role in civic life.
Right.
Gays were excluded, were detested officially, and you see that in the film. You see Jesse Helms, a powerful senator, still powerful even though he's been dead for a decade, who feels so empowered in his anti-gay positions that he's espoused them on the floor of the Senate. That shocks young people when they see the film, that anybody would speak like that, much less publicly, much less an elected official on the floor of the, of our federal government. That can't be done anymore, and that's an enormous breakthrough. We wouldn't be having discussions today about gay marriage if it weren't for the tremendous social and cultural advances that followed the AIDS epidemic as it was being as it was decimating a community and it was being fought by a community. So that's a huge revolution. And in fact, I think that that might be the fastest kind of cultural transformation and integration of an outside community really in human history. It's just in 25 or 30 short years, gay people went from invisibility and revilement to presence in a central way in every aspect of our cultural life.
What is the next frontier, or the current frontier, of the struggle against HIV and AIDS?
Well, there's access, of course, and we talked a little bit about that. How do you get these drugs to? There are 28 million people in the world, 28 million people with HIV who will die the same awful quick death that we were experiencing in this country before the advent of the medication. And that's because the pills are just not there for them. And in the developing world, the pills cost $1 a day. So for about $300 a year, we could keep people alive and, you know, and end the death in the pandemic. And it's not very much money. It can be done. And we just need to find political will to do it. But the next challenge in research is cure research. And in the last 6 or 8 months, scientists have become very excited about the prospects to finally find a way to cure people with HIV, to eradicate HIV from infected people's bodies. And that will be a thrilling breakthrough when that comes. It's not next year or the year after. It may not be in 5 or 10 years, but science has never found a way to rid a body of a virus after infection. And this, when they break through on this for HIV, will have really fundamental ramifications in so many other areas of science and research, including especially cancer. So that's right. Really exciting. And I know that there are people in the laboratories today who think that they're on the path to bring us there, and we can only hope that they're right.
David France is director and co-writer of the documentary How to Survive a Plague. You can find out more about the film at surviveaplague.com, and the documentary opens on October 19th at the CCA. David, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.